The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes.
We are going to get to our first guest of the day momentarily. David Kotok is going to be joining us from Cumberland Advisors to talk about stocks and Libya and Ben Bernanke's speech. But first, it's time for our Tri-State Mercedes-Benz Market Drivers Reports. The Mercedes-Benz Summer Event is back. Visit your Mercedes-Benz Tri-State dealers for limited-time lease and financing offers on select Mercedes-Benz models. They're on the web at searchmercedes.com, your source for everything Mercedes-Benz in the Tri-State. Dom Chu, welcome. Here we go. It looked like stocks were going to have a decent day, and they're giving up the gains. What's going on?
You know what? I'm reminded by that great interview that we had with Marianne Bartels. Chief Technical Strategist over at Bank of America Merrill Lynch, talking about this idea that we had 1145 to 1150 as resistance or a level that the S&P would run out of steam. We saw that today. It went to 1145 and kind of just backed off ever since there. She also mentioned a couple other levels here down below here where we are. 1101 was the next one she had talked about. It has to do with some patterns in the charts and whatnot. So that's another one there. And then below that, an even bigger line there at 1020, 1030. So what you're seeing in action right now in the stock market, perhaps not at all a surprise to certain chart watchers or technicians out there, but it certainly doesn't bode well when you see the momentum kind of waning on a day when you thought that optimism about, like Courtney said, quantitative easing part three might have got stuck maybe up there a little bit. Bank of America, just one of those ones, down 6% today. All the financials are taking a hit. So it'll be interesting to see how this afternoon plays out for sure.
And meanwhile, we've got some individual stocks moving.
We do have some individual stocks moving here. I'm watching BA, Boeing, and Delta Airlines, because a pretty decent-sized order. Delta Airlines reportedly in talks to buy 100 aircraft from Boeing. The list price for that is about $8.5 billion. Now, Delta Airlines doesn't comment on plane orders, so this is just according to people familiar with the matter. So those shares, actually Delta was up solidly about 5, 6% earlier today, giving back all of those gains along with the market here. Boeing still up about 1.2%. Also another decent story here. Stock buybacks continue to be a theme. Lowe's and Travelzoo, both beneficiaries of stock buyback boosts today. So watch those shares. Lowe's about up 1% right now. Travelzoo up about 3%. Again, both of those shares off of their highs of the session, still a boost because of the buyback story. So we're watching a number of names here, but again, we're still keeping an eye on those financials and gold for sure, because like we've been talking about all morning, if it isn't the sign of the times here, the gold ETF, the SPDR, the SPDR ticker GLD, is now the biggest ETF in the world, surpassing the S&P 500 ETF. So just a sign of the times here.
Why does that scare me?
It's a little scary. I mean,
a little bubbly.
I've had a number of people jokingly say about they're going to go buy firearms and Slim Jims and beef jerky and beef stew, because it just seems like the world is heading in a very weird spot.
Well, let's bring in David Kotok now, because he can help put a lot of this in perspective for us. And as we do, I want to let everybody know this portion of the Hayes Advantage is brought to you by Sector Spider ETFs. Time to consider a stock alternative? Visit sectorspiders.com or call 1-866-SECTOR-ETF. And of course, David is the chairman and chief investment officer at Cumberland Advisors. David, welcome.
Hi, Kathleen. Just don't ask me, need Slim Jims.
Well, okay, we got that out of the way pretty quick.
What about Dinty Moore beef stew? I mean, we all like that.
He's a fisherman, so he's probably eaten all kinds of, well, fish and all kinds of things when he had to. And he was
smoked fish is delicious. Deal with smoked fish.
Yeah, but if you don't catch a fish, then you have to dip into those other stores, right?
That's exactly right.
So anyway, he's a rough and rugged guy. You got to be rough and rugged for these markets lately. And David, I think it's interesting in your piece yesterday, you were already focusing on Libya and the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi as the key for the markets, perhaps pushing aside this huge focus we have on Ben Bernanke's speech this Friday, when, if history repeats itself, he could announce another round of quantitative easing. How do you put it all together?
Well, I don't want to push aside Bernanke's speech on Friday. But what I thought is the events in Libya are large. If Libyan oil production comes on in a hurry, and it looks like it could, and it looks like a lot of the infrastructure is in place and repairs can be swift, then you just add 1.5 million barrels of the sweetest crude that Europe desires back into the market. And that could have an impact positively for Europeans and the rest of the world because it could drop the oil price. Certainly, the oil price is not likely to go up initially on that. And in fact, we see some early signs that some price adjustment is taking place, and there's not a single additional barrel yet produced. So my view is that's a positive development in addition to getting rid of a dictator who was no friend of the modern world and the Western world. So that's the combination of things about Libya. It's good news that this is coming to an end and the regime is changing. Well, I don't want to diminish Bernanke. It's a very big issue.
David, one of the things that we talk about right now is the sectors that are leading the markets kind of down, up and around right now. Financials, obviously, in the question here, but you're hitting a good point here. If we have that much more supply of the lightest, sweetest, the best crude, the ones we use for things like gasoline, coming to market, it tends to be bearish, right, for crude. Prices tend to fall when you have supplies pick up again. So what does that mean for those energy companies out there? I mean, are we going to continue to see those shares fall? Because, you know, perhaps a silver lining here, cheaper gas for consumers, but you know, lower stock prices for oil companies out there.
Well, you already have had the energy companies, the oil companies, in a downtrend. We had a long period of time, which peaked at the end of April, in which you had an energy bull market. The best performing sector in the S&P 500 index was the energy sector. The stocks did well, and that peaked around April 29th, coincident with the market peak. They have been relatively weak since.
And if I might add, David, you point out that in May of this year, you took your then overweighted energy position to an underweight in your U.S. stock portfolio.
Yeah, we did. That was a good call. Every once in a while, you can get lucky in this business. and we had been in energy overweight position while the energy group expanded as a proportion of the S&P from somewhere around 9 to 10% of the S&P up to over 13, which is where it peaked at the end of April. Now it has been losing share of S&P, which means it's been falling faster than other sectors, not all of them, but some of them. And energy today is probably around 12% of the S&P, so it's been underperforming other sectors, or at least some of them. We took our weight from an 18 when the energy was 13 to the present position where we are at 6, and the energy sector weight is 12. So we've had a huge swing in energy, and we would stay away from the energy sector until this gets clearer. How far will the oil price go? Who knows?
Well, David, one of the things with oil prices, though, if it's going to be that much of a bearish story for energy, is there a sector that's going to do well on the heels of this whole energy fall?
Well, we think so, because if you look at oil and translate it to something that makes sense for an American investor and an American consumer. A penny a gallon price in gasoline is roughly $1.4 billion a year in spending power. And that ratio is key. We can explore it in more detail when we have the minute, I think.
Well, and we will. David Kotok from Cumberland Advisors, thank you so much. We're going to continue this conversation looking more at how oil and Ben Bernanke this week can affect stocks. That's next on Bloomberg Radio Experience. David Kotok is my guest, Chairman and CIO, Chief Investment Officer at Cumberland Advisors. We're taking a look at the big macro forces pushing stocks. One, hopes that Ben Bernanke will hint at more quantitative easing in his speech this Friday. Two, oil prices with if Muammar Gaddafi is overthrown and a new government is taking over, oil production expected to ramp back up. That's certainly what David thinks. And David, you have a pretty bold forecast, I think, for how low gasoline prices at the pump could fall if Brent crude comes down.
I think we might see gasoline back under $3, a two handle for a gallon of gas, and we're coming off a four handle. The swing is large and should not be underestimated in our view, since every penny a gallon is worth about $1.4 billion a year in spending power in the hands of American consumers. And it looks to me as if American consumers are about to get a tax cut in the form of a lower gasoline price.
Well, David, if we have that spending kind of stimulus there, I mean, is how much is psychology a factor right now? Because we talked to a number of listeners, viewers out there who say, you know, we're going to take the extra cash that we have and pocket it or pay down debt or do something else. So how effective is that kind of that stimulus coming from gasoline prices coming down as opposed to anything else out there?
Well, it has a benefit. How we measure the benefit, how much is psychological, how much of it is saved, how much of it is spent, how long it lasts, all come into an equation. But if you think about the size, and you take gasoline from $4 plus to $2 something, you inject buying power in the hands of the U.S. consumer that's roughly double the amount of money as the payroll tax cut is. That's a very large sum. Now, I don't believe everybody's going to save every dollar. Somebody's going to take one of those dollars and go spend it on a widget and start a consumption expansion.
And anybody who's counting their pennies, and we've had people on the show who run businesses where they deal with lower income people. A lot of people, David, you know, they're spending every cent of every paycheck. And if that gas price comes down and they're able to spend another 20, 30 bucks for their kids back to school, they're going to feel lucky, right? So it could have a huge impact. What I think is so interesting is how this year or so, so many things that have happened have been outside of policymakers' control. The Japanese tsunami. Now, as Ben Bernanke heads to Jackson Hole, gasoline prices, if you're right, are coming down a lot. So now does he go ahead and announce a QE3? Do you need QE3 if gasoline prices get back below $3 a gallon? You know what I mean? This thing seems to complicate things for the Fed.
Well, the assumption was that it was uncomplicated for the Fed to announce QE3. I happen to think it is complicated for the Fed, and the threshold for QE3 is very, very high. And you saw it represented with three dissenting votes in the FOMC. Now, we don't have the benefit of knowing what those three votes would have been had the Libyan events took place before the FOMC. So there's no way to deal with that counterfactual. But what we do know is there's a lot of concern about a QE3. And I suspect there still will be on Friday. So market expectations that Bernanke is going to plant the seed for QE3 in a way in which it can be depended upon, I think, are overdone. If that's the reason people are buyers of stocks this morning, then they may be making a mistake. I think, by the way, that the economy is not going to go into a double-dip recession, that we're not going to have another slump. A slowdown with low inflation is still growth, albeit not robust. And we're in some long period of 1% and 2% real growth and 1% and 2% inflation, not going into a second slump. And the gasoline price cut makes that more likely.
Well, David, the last time we had three dissenting votes in a Fed policy decision was back in 1992. And the general theme among the three dissenters was this idea that the quantitative easing process, this monetary stimulus, wasn't really doing anything for the economy to help it grow, but just doing this asset price inflation kind of game where you saw prices of oil go up and you saw prices of, you know, other commodities go up. So is this a tug of war here? I mean, is it, by embarking on QE3, is the Fed in essence going to raise gasoline prices again?
I don't believe the Fed will raise gasoline prices with QE3. But there are others who will argue the other side of this. It's a controversial issue, so there's a debate. If you look at the three dissenting votes that came from the three presidents, you can understand their viewpoints, and they're pretty transparent about it. Let's flip this to the other side. There are two vacancies on the Board of Governors. So Bernanke has five governors, two vacancies. The five vote as a block. They support the chairman. Bill Dudley, the president of the New York Fed, votes with the chairman. Essentially, he's the president of a regional bank, but as a practical matter, he aligns himself completely with Bernanke. So that's six. And At no time would we expect to have four of the voting presidents oppose the chairman. Three is a very large number. If those two vacancies got filled, this vote would have been 9-3, not 7-3. So it reflects the dissension of regional bank presidents. They are voting out of their conviction. They are worried about future inflationary expectations and inflation if it's realized.
David, can I ask you a quick question before we run out of time? Bill Dudley gave a speech last week where he said the risk of recession is very low and he does expect some pickup in the second half. If he is espousing Ben Bernanke's view, is that what we're hearing from the Fed chairman on Friday then? Does that mean no QE3 because Bill Dudley isn't worried about a recession?
Well, I don't know that that's what Ben Bernanke's going to say on Friday, of course, but the fact is Bernanke's going to walk a middle ground because Bernanke doesn't know. And to attribute to him prescience, which he doesn't have in his ability to forecast, look at the variability of the Fed forecast, you can't be clear. So my guess is Bernanke walks in the middle, covers both sides, leaves his options open.
Okay, David Kotok, thanks for joining us from Cumberland Advisors. Up next, a look at the European debt crisis and what it's doing to European banks on Bloomberg Radio. And that includes 12 of the largest interbank dealers. And for that daily Forex brief, we're going to bring in Sarah Eisen.
Kathleen, we'll stay on the Jackson Hole theme. You're going to be there later this week. A lot of anticipation building into Ben Bernanke. I was talking to Nick Benenbrook of Wells Fargo. He's one of the most accurate currency forecasters, according to Bloomberg rankings. He says it's really hard to like the dollar these days when you have talk of more easing, speculation that the Federal Reserve will do more, take further steps, because all of that is very bearish for the currency. And Nick previously was expecting a dollar rebound. So you have that in the mix. You also have dollar yen trading awfully close to that post-World War II low, which we reached on Friday, 75.95, trading just above it right now as the finance minister in Japan warned that he is ready to take bold and decisive action to fight the currency's strength. So we'll see what happens there. Traders, strategists bracing for some sort of intervention when it comes to the Japanese yen and the Swiss franc. We're also watching that one carefully because we know the SNB, the Swiss National Bank, has been trying to keep its currency from strengthening to near record highs versus the euro and the dollar. An interesting world that we live in, Kathleen. The theme is high alert for intervention. Mark Chandler, Brown Brothers Harriman, telling us last hour on Bloomberg Radio. Take a look at at Sweden's currency, the Swedish krona, or the stocky, as we like to nickname it in the foreign exchange market. Superior fundamentals, a surplus, an economy that's been growing, and relatively low debt. Economy has been slowing a bit, but he sees the outlook as very positive, and he would suggest that that might be a place to go if you're clamoring for safety, if you have this negative view of the U.S. dollar, as so many people do these days.
Sarah Eisen, thank you so very much, setting us up so well, as always, for our next guest. And this portion of the Hayes Advantage is brought to you by Jaguar XJ. Test drive the 2011 Jaguar XJ with a 5-year, 50,000-mile new vehicle limited warranty. Complimentary scheduled maintenance and wear and tear items. Owning a Jaguar is even better. Visit tristatejaguar.com today. Charles Gushy joins me now, Managing Director at Global Equity Sales for Auerbach & Grayson. Charles, welcome. First time on the show.
Pleasure, Kathleen.
So there's so many issues to cover with you, and one of the things we want to definitely dig into is banks and so many concerns. We're seeing it, stories about Danish banks and Greek banks helping other banks so nobody notices what trouble they're in. Some interesting stories on the terminal today. But broadly, when you look at the big forces, Ben Bernanke is going to speak in Jackson Hole. Oil prices may be falling. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, still not ready to go full tilt on a plan, it seems, to end the debt crisis and keep the euro together. What are you looking at? What do you put all together?
Well, as your previous commentators were saying, the market's extremely hungry for a safe haven, and unfortunately, this ain't it. The issue that you have with the banks is that they have gotten extremely cheap versus their historical valuations. If you look at price to book, they're running at around half of where they used to average, which is a deep discount to book value in Europe. The problem is there's a million very good reasons why they're cheap. Number one is that they are not likely to realize the same returns in the future that they realized in the past. So it's an extremely good reason to put a big fat discount on the valuation on these things. And that looks to me to be very durable in terms of sticking around as a cheap level.
Well, if we, again, take the big picture look here, we know that the United States got through its financial crisis, right? 2008 September's, you know, what an interesting anniversary, right? Now the focus is on Europe and its financial crisis, the debt crisis, and its banks. U.S., between the Treasury and the Fed, supported the biggest U.S. bank. So I think that's a very important question. Can the ECB, can the German and the French government step up and promise a big enough of a stability fund so that people conclude the banks will make it through and they'll rescue these big banks that hold a lot of this lousy sovereign debt?
Well, the problem you have is that that's difficult to do. Of course, in Europe, what you have is an attempt to make one big fat balance sheet to back up the sovereign debt. Getting there, though, you have to basically get the Germans to go along and backstop the weaker players, and they're insisting that they also cover the fiscal policies to some extent in terms of directing and disciplining the different fiscal decision makers at the national level. Every player doing this basically at the end of the day has to stand up in front of their voters and get reelected. So you add all that together, they're not going to give up, but it's going to be a long, bloody, drawn-out process at a minimum, and it doesn't imply that you're looking better visibility by the next couple of months. So in terms of the way markets work, of course, those are all great reasons to put big discounts on equities, and that's what you've got. When I look at the European banks, they're in that negative spiral. At the same time that you have all of that, they also are being forced by their regulators to increase their capital. That's related to meltdown after the subprime and a response to recapitalize the banks so that for the next one they'll be sitting on a fatter capital base. From the standpoint of a bank, though, it means that you have to run with less leverage and you have to be raising a bunch of money, not necessarily because you have a way to make big profits off of it, but because you just have to have a higher core tier one ratio to show to the market. And I think that means that return on equity, which is the key measure for banking profitability, is going to be a much lower number going forward. That's already somewhat reflected in valuations, but most of those equity sales are ahead of us. So at this, you know, the average price to book in Europe is 0.6 on a bank. If you assume that they're going to take a discount to that and issue a bunch of fresh stock, then you're even diluting it further, with most of the capital raises still to come.
And as you have pointed out in your recent research, there's another issue is just the fact that the European economy looks like it's slowing down. The last number on Eurozone GDP was weak, and even Germany was weak.
Exactly. I mean, they are related, but you know, to a large extent, that's a separate issue where GDP was doing very well. Germany was a huge export boom story. And while that is not necessarily over, it is clearly decelerating and running out of gas. So you've got estimate cuts happening, profitability under pressure, additional pressure. And, of course, if you're a bank, that means that your customers who are businesses are likely to have a higher level of losses. That raises your provisions. And, in particular, the yield curve that reflects some of that risk is flattening out. The yield curve is an normally easy money trade for banks in recessions where they borrow at very low short-term rates and then they can lend it out at much higher interest rates, which are typically longer-term loans, and they basically can mint money for some period of time and fatten their balance sheets up and so forth. As that flattens out, it cuts their ability to do that. It hurts their spreads in their core businesses. So it's yet another source of pressure on producing the profit that's going to justify all this fresh capital they're asking you for.
Well, it seems to me that the European debt crisis, in some sense, is the least of their worries. Because if this got solved tomorrow, they'd still have the problem of having to raise their capital levels, right? They'd still have a slower economy. All these things going on. If the European leaders can't put a floor under this debt crisis, seems like the banks are really, really on shaky ground.
Well, they are. Now, they have already fallen off a cliff, of course. So I think to reverse the sector and make money on the equities, you probably just have to reverse one or another of these factors pretty convincingly, and then you've probably got severe upside. It's easy to model on some nice banks, 50% plus upside on the valuations.
Okay, we're going to continue our conversation with Charles Gushy, Managing Director for Global Equity Sales at Auerbach Grace & Company, looking at European banks here on Bloomberg Radio. And this portion of the Hays Advantage is brought to you by the Lincoln Summer Exclusive Event. And just a reminder, Hays Advantage Live, Thursday and Friday, 10 to 1 Jackson Hole time. That's our usual 12 to 3 p.m. Eastern time, with all kinds of guests to talk about what's at stake on Thursday and then on Friday to analyze what the Fed chairman has or hasn't said in this highly anticipated speech. So Charles Gushy is my guest. He's Managing Director, Global Equity Sales, Auerbach Grayson. And Charles, when broadly speaking for financials, for banks, for the industry, is Jackson Hole a turning point? Is it a turning point if Ben Bernanke doesn't step up and say he's going to do more? Is it a turning point if he does?
Well, he already came out last week and basically gave a solid guarantee to the markets that he would never hike interest rates for the foreseeable future. So unless he's going to start aggressively paying me to borrow money, I don't think he can do a heck of a lot more. What he's up against is a big series of expectations, a political backdrop that is unfavorable to low interest rates for the foreseeable future, and the status of treasuries as a safe haven trade. I just think that the guy has an probably undoable task in front of him. The whole problem you have with financial markets is if you're looking for the safe haven, where in the heck are you going to put your money? And you can only typically buy up so much gold, so much Swiss franc, so much Swedish kroner before your portfolio is looking pretty one-sided on its weightings. So I have an alternative trade. I think anytime you have this kind of a macro, massive sell-off, there will be a certain number of babies thrown out with the bathwater, which are companies that maybe cosmetically look like they are in those sectors, and therefore when the portfolio managers are selling off the sectors, they get sold off, but they may in fact not be as vulnerable to the negative catalysts that are out there in the market.
Well, let's look at some of those babies. There's so much focus, of course, for U.S. investors on U.S. banks, you know, the B of A's, the regional banks, et cetera. But talk to us about some of these European bank babies that may get thrown out.
Yeah, I can't really comment on the U.S. I mean, at Auerbach Grayson, we cover 128 equity markets, none of them U.S., but almost every place else.
But there's so many people who are looking for these overseas opportunities and global opportunities. That's one of the reasons we wanted to have you on the show today.
Exactly. So for out-of-favor names that nevertheless are unlikely to get whacked, in the financials, I would take a close look at Swiss Re. This is one of the top reinsurance players on the globe. It's a large-cap stock. Its history is somewhat tainted. They had a management change coming out of subprime. They were one of the most exposed companies, so they had to, you know, hit the reset button on everything that they do. Today, they have almost no sovereign debt exposure sitting on their balance sheet. That includes U.S. treasuries, which are small for them, and the pigs, which are almost non-existent. And that's the big issue for the sector, and the big reason why the sector has been sold off. They're essentially immune from having a, you know, exposure to a Greek debt default or something like that. And when I look at their earnings, they saw double-digit upgrades on the back of their Q2 to EPS estimates, as analysts were kind of caught sleeping on that. Their underlying business is booming because on the back of hurricane season, on the back of Japan, and of course the typhoon that hit earlier in the year, and on the back of the fact that many other financial players are somewhat impaired by capital markets, they're seeing rising pricing. Their net premiums grew double the estimated growth rate in second quarter. In the midst of all that, the stock sold off anyway, and it's now on deep single-digit PEs next year. It's paying a 7% dividend yield on next year in a 1% yield world. To me, that smells like value. I think this is a very good one to buy, and unlike the banks, doesn't have any need to rush out, raise new capital, isn't up against those sure. regulator rules that
and
we talked
and
about.
A pretty well-known name, I'd say. Let's run through a couple other institutions that you are looking at, either as buys or maybe ones to sell if you get a chance. How about GAM, GAM Holding?
GAM Holding is a great smaller play. This is a 100% asset manager, so it's got nothing to do with lending money, borrowing money so that you can lend, lending spreads. They are a spin-out from Julius Baer, which is one of the big private Swiss banks. The big story with GAM Holding in this environment is their excess capital, where they're sitting on the equivalent of about a third of their total market cap in what amounts to net cash, with approval from shareholders to pay out 20% of that to shareholders via a shareholder buyback. They've been slow to pull the trigger on that, but once that kicks in, which could be as soon as this week after they announce their results, you're likely to see a very supportive element on what's already an extremely cheap stock.
Vienna Insurance Group.
This is the leading CEECIS player. That's Eastern Europe and Russia. In the insurance business, they were very early to buy up local insurance companies and put together a network, and that's all they do. It's bricks and mortar, nuts and bolts, selling insurance products to local companies, local people. They don't play around with the balance sheet. It's growing double digit. It's in deep single digit PEs. And that stock with the insurance sector has sold off to a very attractive entry level.
Okay, now a lightning round. If you need a benchmark bank, Deutsche Bank.
It is the best of the big European benchmark banks for the simple reason that they anticipate trends very successfully. In subprime, they were short on subprime paper going through the whole crisis and never had to do a rescue capital increase. The latest example is on PIGS debt, where in the course of this year's first half, they reduced their exposure by 70%.
Wow. That's great. Yeah. Quickly, and I just want to make sure we get this out there. You say you would sell UniCredit
correct.
And Raiffeisen.
Raiffeisen in Austria, correct.
Okay.
I'd be a seller on both those names.
Well, I just want to get that out because I said we would tell people your sales too. Charles, thanks so much for joining us. This was great. It was Charlie Gushy from Auerbach Grayson. Up next, we are going to be looking at oil and Libya on Bloomberg Radio.
You can subscribe to Bloomberg's premium podcast service at Bloomberg.com/Tom Keen and listen to The Hayes Advantage weekdays at noon Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM satellite radio channel 113. Copyright 2011 Bloomberg LP.